So thanks a lot for the invitation. It's my first time here, and I'm very excited to meet with all of you. I'll be telling you today about searches for fundamental symmetry violations with atoms and molecules. I'll start with just a few notes about what I'm going to talk about. I'm mostly going to talk about CP violation searches, such as EDMs, in atoms and molecules, mainly just because this is what I know, this is what I work on. So I won't, for example, talk about things like nucleon or nucleus EDMs, nuclear EDMs. Many of the ideas that I talk about will be directly applicable to a wide range of atomic and molecular science outside of fundamental symmetry violations, reaching into things like high energy physics, quantum information science, chemistry. I'm an atomic molecular optical experimentalist, so don't believe anything I say about theory. I'll say very little about theory. I won't give a review of this. I have some to suggest if you'd like to learn more. please feel free to get in touch with me anytime if you want to talk about any of this or anything else. Please ask a lot of questions, both during the talk and afterward. The slides are on the Indico site if you want to follow along on your computer. I'll start with some background and motivation to explore things like, why are we interested in CP violation at low energy, and how are atoms and molecules used for these searches? Much more the former than the latter, just because, again, I'm an experimentalist. But just to give you a quick overview of some context and motivation from a particle physics and cosmology standpoint, a lot of the motivation, but not all the motivation for this type of research is that there's a large observed imbalance between matter and antimatter in the universe. It appears to be basically all of one and none of the other. This is called the baryon asymmetry problem. How can we explain this? You could, for example, one model is maybe there's some new, some undiscovered particle which was created after the Big Bang, which preferentially decays into matter, thus leaving a universe that's full of matter with little to no antimatter. Sakharov worked through the conditions for such a model to explain a matter-filled universe, found a few conditions. One of them, which is relevant for this work, is the existence of CP-violating processes, so charge, parity, conjugation violation, which must exist outside the standard model. The standard model has CP violation in it, but it's not enough to explain a matter-dominated universe by many orders of magnitude. So this new undiscovered CP-violating physics at high energies would manifest itself in a number of ways. One way that's of interest to me is that it would give rise fairly generically to symmetry-violating, in particular CP-violating, electromagnetic moments in standard model objects. So if there's, you know, some new particle, say, couples to the electron with a symmetry CP-violating coupling, this can give rise to, at low energy, this gives rise, the observable for this interaction is an electric dipole moment of the particle. So this gives rise to things like, for fundamental particles, it gives rise to electric dipole moments, EDMs. In composite things like nuclei, it can give rise to effects like nuclear shift moments and magnetic quadrupole moments, both of which I will talk about. And the reason, the connection between symmetry violation and these moments is because these moments must lie along the intrinsic spin of the object, the particle, the nucleus, simply because there's no other internal vectors describing these things. You know, the spin is the only internal vector that describes an electron or a neutron. So if it has a dipole moment, it has to lie along the spin. And that's a problem because the electric dipole moment is a p odd t even quantity, whereas spin is a p even t odd quantity. So forcing these two things to be aligned creates a lot of problems, or it requires violation of these symmetries. You can picture this, again, this is a very classical picture, but I like it because it gives intuition about these symmetry violations. if you imagine a particle, like an electron or neutron, and it has a spin, and you also assume it has a dipole moment. If you simply look at this particle in a mirror, the sense of the spin would not change in the mirror, but the sense of the dipole moment would reverse. But we know that all electrons are indistinguishable, all neutrons are indistinguishable, so one of these particles can exist. So the very existence of this moment means that there's some intrinsic, in this case, you know, parity, mirror reflection, symmetry violation in the universe. And similarly with time reversal, if you look at this thing spinning and you reverse the flow of time, it would be spinning in the opposite direction, but the dipole moment wouldn't change. Again, that particle doesn't exist. You could by what I mean by it doesn't exist is you could distinguish this from this by applying fields, and we know that you can't distinguish electrons or neutrons from each other. So the very existence of these moments, EDMs, electric dipole moments, violate P and T, as you know, as I've shown. They also violate CP if you assume conservation of CPT. To make the connection back to high energy physics, the current experiments for looking, for example, for the electron EDM are generically sensitive to CP violating particles and forces which couple to the electron. And if they couple at one loop, you can ask, okay, given the experimental sensitivity, what kind of mass reach do you have for these experiments? And if you make a simple estimate for this kind of most generic model, you'd find that the current experimental limit on the electron EDM gives you a limit on this mass of this particle coupling to the electron with an order unity CP violating phase of about 50 TeV. If you make it a two-loop process, then you're probing about the sort of half to two TeV scale or so. So pretty high energy scales. It's background free, unlike in the last talk. We don't have to worry about EDM backgrounds because the standard model value is small. It's at least several orders of magnitude lower than the current experimental limit. Turns out this is interpreting this is actually very complicated. There's a poster about it if you want to learn more this afternoon. But it's so small because at least the sort of direct electron EDM arises from the CKM mechanism, so the CP violation that we know about in the standard model, at four loops. So it's very, very suppressed. So we don't have to worry about sort of subtracting away a standard model background in this case. Of course, this is a fairly generic model. For specific models, the energy reach of these searches can be much higher, can also be much lower, depending on the details of the model. But generally, it's pretty high. But I also like to point out and remind people that EDMs are just one of the many tools we have to search for new physics at high energies. I like this plot because it shows for some particular brand of supersymmetry, what are the superpartner mass limits that we can get from experiments. And you can see that for all of these different particles, the most sensitive limit comes from either a direct search like the LHC or EDM searches or flavor violation searches. So there's really a broad community looking for these sorts of things. Another thing, these shaded areas indicate improvements since this paper was written. So it's also, there's a lot of advances across the board looking for these new fundamental particles and forces. So if you want to measure an EDM, conceptually, it's very simple. You just take your particle, your electron or your neutron, you prepare its spin perpendicular to some electric and magnetic fields, and you let it precess for some amount of time. So the dipoles feel torques in these fields. They precess, and after some amount of time, they'll accumulate some phase, which arises from the magnetic and electric effects. If you then repeat the experiment with the electric field reversed, the magnetic precession is unchanged, but the electric precession phase angle will change sign. So if you do these two experiments and take a difference, you get something that's proportional to what you want to measure, the dipole moment, and then two things which you presumably know from the experimental setup. So if you want this observable to be large, this observable, that's this phase angle here, if you want this to be large, so that you have good sensitivity, I didn't get to that part yet. So the observable is this phase, which again is proportional to this quantity you want to measure. If you calculate what's the sensitivity which you'd like to be small, for repeated measurements, it depends like this, with the field that the dipole sees, the time that it coherently processes, and then the total number of measurements that you can do. So you want all these things to be large so that your sensitivity, your uncertainty is small. So you want large fields, you want long coherent interactions where the particles are coherently processing in these fields, and you want a large number of measurements. So let's make all of these large. For the electric field, the biggest electric field you can find anywhere reasonably is the field inside atoms and molecules. They have extremely large fields. If you do a back of the envelope estimate, you'd find that it's maybe gigavolts per centimeter. If you turns out if you do a sort of proper calculation for heavy species, where there's a lot of there's a lot of charge in the nucleus, this can be up to 100 gigavolts per centimeter. For suitable heavy species. If that unit full quantity doesn't mean very much to you, you should compare that to the maximum-ish laboratory field over macroscopic volumes you can create, which is around a million times smaller. So you get a huge amplification of the field by using the internal fields in an atom and molecule. And you also sort of get them for free. I'm not saying like, oh, just take a particle and put it in an atom. Just use, atoms are made of particles and they experience these fields. The observable then in an experiment like this would be if the, say, the electron has a permanent electric dipole moment, it will cause an energy splitting between two different spin states, spin up and spin down of the electron relative to this internal electric field. and this internal field will directly amplify the size of this splitting, which ultimately is what you're looking for in experiments. This simple picture has a few caveats, and I'll explain what those are because they help to understand why people use the species that they use to look for these effects in atoms and molecules. Also, they're neat. so the first picture, the first caveat to this very simple internal field picture is, I drew the electron kind of sitting up there, but that, even classically, that doesn't happen. It orbits around, this dipole interaction would average away to zero. And this is always the case. Eigenstates in atoms and molecules have well-defined parity, so the expectation value of this interaction has to be zero, exactly, always. The solution is to polarize the species. So use an external electric field to pull the electron and the nucleus apart a little bit so that now this effect no longer averages to zero. The solution to that problem I just told you about. We've already solved it, so let's keep going. so how do you polarize an atom or molecule, or what's a good way to think about polarizing an atom or molecule, or a quantum mechanical object generally? so atoms and molecules, they're always symmetric. Their orbitals, their eigenstates are always symmetric in zero field. things like S or P, maybe this doesn't look symmetric, but when you sort of square it to look at where the charge is spending time, it is, it has no preferred direction. But if you apply an external field to mix these states which have opposite parity, then you can get lopsided states like this, which do have some dipole moment. so in order to do this, if you think about it from a perturbation theory standpoint, you have to overcome a perturbation, an electric field, large enough to overcome the energy splitting delta between these two states, whatever they may be. therefore, this is an induced dipole. It's not a permanent dipole. You're inducing it by applying a field, which induces a dipole by mixing these two states. And the EDM sensitivity, and just more generally, the CP violation sensitivity, so including things that aren't EDMs that I'll talk about later, they're always proportional to the fractional polarization. so it's sort of the degree to which you can mix these opposite parity states. And this is always true. So nothing, this is a bit of an aside, but nothing has a permanent EDM, except of course in the presence of like CP violating physics. including things that textbooks often talk about having permanent electric dipole moments like water or salt or the N equals 2 state in hydrogen. Those don't actually have permanent dipole moments. And in a practical sense, if you were to measure the, and you, I mean, people have done these sorts of things. If you measure the, say, energy of interaction versus electric field for species, for any species that's ever been studied, the actual shift behaves like an induced dipole, meaning at low fields it acts, it has a quadratic shift. At high fields, it asymptotes to a linear shift as you fully induce the dipole. Yes. These two states?
Yeah,
because these two states, if you reflected these in a mirror, this one would not change sign, this one would change sign. And so that, so parity meaning just the mapping of like R to minus R, R vector to minus R vector, would flip the sign of this one but not this one. And you can show that you can only get this dipole moment when you mix states of opposite parity. If you mix states of the same parity, you'll never get this sort of lopsided shape.
And how does the electric field do that?
Yeah, how does the electric field do that? So, good question. If you think of it for, if this is, say, an electron, actually, this I think this picture kind of, you know, intuitively, this is how I think about it. when you apply an electric field, because the nucleus and the electron have opposite charges, they're kind of pulled in different directions, and so you expect classically, simplistically, like, oh, you should get some state where the electron kind of spends more time on one side than on the other. And then if you ask, well, quantum mechanically, what does that mean? That means you're sort of, by pulling the electron away in one direction, you're kind of mixing in some of this kind of P, you know, this P-type character. Because by adding these two things, that gives you exactly something like this, where you have the electron spending more time on one side than the other. So that's kind of a semi-classical way to think about it.
I guess my question is, like, how are you adding in the P state? Does it start in the S state?
Yeah, or if it starts, it could start in the S state, it could start in the P state. But by adding this electric field, that S state won't be an eigenstate anymore. If you add this external field, now the eigenstates are actually, you know, mixtures of these.
Okay.
And so this type of problem is usually discussed in the context of the hydrogen atom. So at least in Shankar, which is like the book where I learned, you know, quantum mechanics, you go through the Stark effect in hydrogen, kind of is basically exactly this. It's like, you know, what causes the energy shifts in the hydrogen atom when you put it in an electric field? You know, it's this. It's that you mix, you know, S states and P states, you know, like the 2S and 2P states in hydrogen. The electric field mixes them. The eigenstates are no longer purely S or purely P. They're mixtures, and the mixtures look like this, where the electron wave function is lopsided and has like a dipole moment where it's spending more time on one side than the other. Yeah. Any other questions? Watch your head.
So I'm just a little bit confused about the statement that's in a couple bullet points about this nothing has a permanent EDM. So I think part of your statement is that, like, oh, water can rotate in any direction. So, you know, if I just apply an electric field, that's going to make it sit in one direction. But without applying an electric field, it doesn't sit in one direction. Is that the entire content of the statement, or is there something else?
That's pretty much it. There are many, many ways to interpret this statement. But what you said is a perfect, and that's kind of how I think about it, that in the absence of any fields, all the physics that describes the system is completely rotationally symmetric. There can be no preferred direction in a vacuum from all the physics we know about for the direction of this sort of, you know, charge separation. And the reason that's the case is sort of exactly what you said, that like quantum mechanical things can rotate, and the eigenstates correspond to where they're rotating around, and that dipole moment averages away to zero. Of course, you can put them in superposition states where they are pointing in one direction, but then what they'll actually do is like radiate that energy away. And so in equilibrium, in steady state, nothing has a permanent dipole moment. You can sort of dynamically polarize things, steady state, equilibrium, never have a permanent dipole moment.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
in the back.
I'm still confused by this last point a little bit. So, like with the example with salt,
Are you saying that you don't consider any scenarios where the salt, like a single salt molecule, is somehow attached to something that's an external? You're just talking about freely existing molecules cannot.
If you like stuck salt to a surface or something, it's like, well, now you're breaking symmetry. You have some surface to break the symmetry of the problem, and then you can polarize something. But if you're in vacuum, but then the salt molecule doesn't really have a permanent dipole moment. It's that you've induced it by putting it next to the surface.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Great questions.
I'll ask one other question, which is, there are, I think it just falls into the same category, but there are atoms with, you know, some funky nuclear structure where the nucleus has some, you know, asymmetry or is blobby shaped or something. I could imagine that this also has some induced, you know, maybe lower order effect on the atomic, the electron energy levels and things like this. Does this just fall into this category of still quadratic, or is there something I'm missing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I'll show a picture of one of those nuclei later. I won't go into the details of the kind of the physics of the deformation, but in steady state, that nucleus is still rotating around, and it will rotate around such that that shape will average away. It turns out CP violating effects can make that not the case and can sort of intrinsically align the nucleus in an atom, which I'll talk a little bit about later. But there are still, even though it's rotating, there are still observable effects, and actually one of the really cool, there are many like cool observations of this, but one sort of contemporary neat observation of this effect is from Vlad and Vuletich's group at MIT, where they're looking, they're mapping things called King plots, which is basically looking at isotope shifts of atoms, in their case, a terbium. as you add more neutrons, you can show that the effect of adding more neutrons on some observable in atoms and the energy levels of the electrons should have a linear shape. And that's just because like, well, you add neutrons, the nucleus gets bigger, the nucleus has a charge, it perturbs the energy levels. and you know, great. So that's kind of like just the well-known isotope shifts in atoms. But if you can measure them very precisely, deviations from non-linearity could come from like new bosons, or it could come from funky deformed nuclear shapes that, you know, as you add more nuclei, the sort of shape of the nucleus changes as it rotates around, and that can lead to, you know, extremely tiny shifts on the energy levels of the electrons, but shifts that you can see these days.
Thank you.
Great questions. And so this fact that sensitivity to CP violation relies on the ability to efficiently polarize, or is enhanced in systems where you can efficiently polarize, is a big differentiating factor between atoms and molecules. So in atoms, states of opposite parity are electronic excitations, which are, you know, tens or hundreds of terahertz in frequency. And so even with very large fields, you can only fractionally polarize atoms to about a part per thousand. molecules have, you know, generically have rotational structure, which is a ladder of opposite parity states split by a much smaller energy of, you know, 10 gigahertz or so in terms of frequency. So factor of a, you know, million or so, thousand or so. sometimes these splittings are even smaller. I'll revisit that later. But this is, you know, they're typically around this or smaller, and that means you can get order unity polarizations at something like 10 kilovolts per centimeter, which is a field that you can certainly realize in the laboratory. So for this reason, people usually say, you know, in summary, molecules around 1,000 times more intrinsically sensitive. Doesn't mean the experiments are more sensitive, but it means the sort of intrinsic amplifications of these effects in molecules are around 1,000 times more sensitive, simply because you can polarize molecules efficiently, whereas you can't polarize atoms efficiently in a static field. There's a second caveat to this sort of simple internal field picture is what's called shift shielding or Schiff's theorem. And it's that it turns out that electrons and nuclei experience zero average electric field even when you polarize them. And so you can see this by observing that, well, atoms and molecules don't accelerate in static electric fields. That's just an empirical fact. So the average force, which is proportional to the average electric field experienced by every constituent, has to be zero in steady state. So in other words, the charged particles move to a point where they see zero average field. and so we would say that the charges are screened or shielded from seeing an average DC electric field. this is true, but there are ways around it. I should probably have a third bullet point here, which is that this only holds for DC fields, not necessarily for alternating fields. but the two that I'll talk about are that turns out relativistic electron motion breaks this rule, and also the fact that nuclei, as I mentioned, have complex shapes get around this. The relativistic effects, or why electrons evade Schiff's theorem, is because, or one way to interpret it, is that the dipole moment of the electron experiences a Lorentz contraction. There's some correlation between velocity and position in the atom. You know, it's moving faster as it's closer to the nucleus, semi-classically. So that means that this the dipole moment of the electron is not a constant in the atom because of this Lorentz contraction. So the average field, electric field, may be zero, but the effective electric field is not zero. So D dot E can still average to something that isn't zero. And that's defined as an effective electric field experienced by the electron. This, because it relies on this like relativistic Lorentz contraction, it turns out that this effective electric field depends very strongly on the short range electronic wave functions near the nucleus. So in order to calculate things like this, you need sort of very relativistic quantum mechanics, quantum chemical methods. and there's also an important observation that you need core penetrating electron orbitals. You need electrons that actually get close to the nucleus, so they have these large Lorentz contractions. So that means basically S or P orbitals. Higher orbitals don't really get very close. So S, things with S and P electron orbitals are going to be coming up a lot. So people sometimes say, for example, these effective fields are a purely relativistic effect because they only, in the absence of these relativistic effects, the energy shifts would be exactly zero by Schiff's theorem. And this effective field, because it's a relativistic effect, it scales pretty strongly with the proton number, roughly the cube of the proton number. So these get really high pretty quickly as you get as you go down the periodic table. So what about nuclei? Can you observe nuclear EDMs? The nuclear motion is definitely not relativistic. So you're not going to get that evasion. But you can get around it by observing that that nuclei are not points. They're not point charges. And in fact, only the charge in the nucleus will be screened. So the protons will be screened. But the electric dipole moment of the nucleus does not arise from just the protons. It arises from other things in the nucleus. And those two distributions need not overlap. So if you have, you know, so the charge and the EDM distribution in a nucleus, if they don't overlap exactly, you can be left with something called a nuclear Schiff moment, or NSM, which is something that arises from the mismatch between, say, the charge and mass distributions in a nucleus. And the way this gives rise to an observable is that this thing looks sort of like a charged shell with like a dipole distribution. So it creates, effectively, it creates an internal electric field aligned with the nuclear spin, which is CP violating. You know, have a spin and an electric field aligned, so that's, you know, a P-violating, T-violating thing. And then this sort of internal electric field, in some sense, that lives in the nucleus mixes core-penetrating electron orbitals, like S and P orbitals. So again, even though you don't have this relativistic electron motion thing, you actually still need core-penetrating electron orbitals basically exactly like electron EDM searches. And it's also enhanced in high Z nuclei, just like in electron EDM searches. So there's a lot of similarities, except now there's a key difference that this requires a nuclear spin. You can't define any sort of moments, CP-violating moments, unless you have a nuclear spin of at least a half. And this effect can be significantly enhanced in deformed nuclei, so nuclei which are not a sphere, because instead of being a little teeny shell, the nuclear shift moment will be like a big mess, which is good. I mean, this is an almost perfect cancellation. You don't want a perfect cancellation. You want like a big messy blob left over, and that can happen in these highly deformed nuclei. For example, nuclei that look like this. This is radium-224. It has what's called an octopole deformation, so meaning it has this people usually say pear shape, but since I live in California, I'd say it's an avocado shape. This avocado shape leads to a nuclear shift moment in radium and in some other similarly deformed species, which are enhanced by a lot, 100,000, even more. A challenge is that these species, the heavy, spinful, deformed nuclei, which is what you'd ideally want to work with to do an experiment like this, it just turns out they're all short-lived. That's just how it goes. It's like actinides. This octopole deformation is actually not very common. So you have to work with these radioactive species. But because you can double dip from the enhancement, you get this intrinsic nuclear enhancement. You also still get this large enhancement from the large electromagnetic fields present in molecules. So you get intrinsic amplifications of something like 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 or even more. Intrinsic amplification, say, versus atoms with spherical nuclei.
Is the picture that you have, is that of the shift moment?
Is it of what?
Is that picture B, the one on top, is that of the shift moment?
No, this is of sort of the mass distribution in the nucleus.
Okay.
This shows that it has an octopole, a static octopole deformation.
So when you subtract off the mass distribution, when you subtract off the EDM from the charge, and you said that mismatches because of the mass distribution, is that, basically, how do you get different shapes between the charge and the EDM from their previous from your previous slide?
Yeah. So in other words, why is this? Why are the charge and mass distributions not as well overlapped? Is that the question?
Or rather, why is the EDM the mass distribution?
Oh, just because sort of if you make the naive assumption, which is in fact naive but still not so bad, that say this is arising from nucleon, electron and proton EDMs, then the EDM distribution is just coming from where's the mass, where are the neutrons and protons, because that's where the EDM distribution is. It turns out that there's a big contribution to things the strong force or new CP violating nuclear forces. So it's not just neutron and proton EDMs, but that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. Thank you.
In the back.
Hi. So my understanding is that you're trying to evade the fact that atoms and molecules experience net average zero force. So you need relativistic effect. But why can't you work with charged ion to start with?
Why did you say why? What about, can you say the last part again?
Why can't you work with charged particle to start with, instead of at neutral atoms?
So do you mean if you want to look at the nucleus, just get a bare nucleus kind of thing?
Yeah.
So I think there are a couple, people do that. So you can do that. Some advantages of this approach are, one is that you get these large enhancements due to the large fields. So if you're going to take your charged thing and put it in an electric field, in order to get a big observable, you want the biggest electric field you can find. And you can't find an electric field bigger than the ones in atoms and molecules.
Uh-huh.
There's also the technical complication, which is that if it's charged, you put it in a field, it will move. Of course, there's a solution to that, which is, you know, make a storage ring. So, you know, that's what people do to get around that trick. But one of the reasons that I like the atom and molecule approach is that you can use sort of like modern sort of ultra-cold quantum control type stuff, which would be hard to do otherwise, though not impossible.
Thank you. Hi, I have a question about the first point you made on slide 18.
So yeah.
I've heard that there's some more recent work by these groups that says that there could be large static or dynamic optical deformations in stable nuclei, such as dysprosium, europium, and gadolinium, and that can lead to very large shift moments. I'm just wondering, what is the general consensus in the field about whether this is reliable, like the numeric results?
Yeah, so that's this island down here. That's like the rare Earths. And my understanding is that I get the impression that it's still kind of an unresolved question. I'm not an expert in that kind of stuff, so I don't have an opinion on the matter, most importantly. you know, for those of you who watch this video, I have no opinion on whether your thinking is right or wrong. my understanding is that the confusion or the disagreements arise when thinking about sort of how big are these octopole moments, but maybe more importantly, how do they manifest as a nuclear shift moment? Because just because something has this deformation does not also mean it has a big nuclear shift moment. That requires a number of other things like the energy levels. It turns out you need mixing of opposite parity states in the nucleus. So it depends on the energy levels. It depends on the parity of those states. Those can not always be easy to know, especially for excited states. So I think that's sort of the complication with these. Also, they're lighter. So even if you get big enhancements, you'll still get, you know, you'll kind of get bigger enhancements with these just because they're heavier. But I think these here, there's not much controversy. These octopole deformations are pretty well known. The effect of how these manifest as nuclear shift moments in this actinide region is reasonably well understood. There are definitely open questions, and it's not easy or solved, but I think there's general agreement that, like, you know, in this region, you really do get these enhancements, and everyone's on board with that.
Okay, thanks.
So I have a question about the upper right plot. So you're saying this is the shape of the nucleus. Is this based on ab initio calculations? Or is there some measurement that one can do to get that shape?
Yeah, this is data. This is a measurement. So people can also calculate these shapes. But this is the result of a measurement.
And
there are not very many of those measurements because they're very hard to do. Because, you know, you can't actually look at the shape of the nucleus. So you infer the shape based on its energy levels, the decays of those energy levels, et cetera.
but then you have to apply a model that correlates the energy levels to to the distribution.
Right, and my again, don't quote me too much on this because that's that the nuclear stuff is kind of outside of my area of expertise. But my understanding is that ab initio method or density functional methods for these heavy nuclei with like lots of protons and neutrons are pretty good at calculating this kind of thing. But yeah, in terms of how those models relate to their interpretation of the data, that I couldn't really comment on too much or at all, I guess. Yeah, these are great questions. I'm really glad people are asking questions. Right, yeah, so the combined with molecular enhancements, you can get potentially very, very, very big enhancements. And one of the kind of open questions still is that there's this basically one case of protactinium-229, which maybe offers another factor of 100 to 1,000 on top of this. But that's under, people don't know. People don't know the answer to that yet, but there's some evidence that that's the case. another way to evade Schiff's theorem is just forget about electric fields, just think about magnetic fields. Magnetic fields are not screened, just like gravity. You know, there's no There are no magnetic monopoles, so there's no magnetic screening. and so if you have CP violating magnetic moments, those won't be screened away. And here's a CP violating magnetic moment, a magnetic quadrupole moment generally violates these symmetries, and they can exist in the nucleus. An intuitive way to think about how that can arise is if, say, a nucleus had a valence nucleon orbiting around in this spinful nucleus, and if that nucleon had an EDM, that orbiting EDM would make a magnetic quadrupole moment that's sort of correlated with the spin. For basically the same reasons, this violates the same symmetries as EDMs. You know, you have some alignment of orbital, of like angular momentum and spatial degrees of freedom. So in this case, you need a nuclear spin of at least one to even define a quadrupole moment. And again, like in the other cases, you get enhancement in high Z nuclei, so high, you know, heavy nuclei. And you also get an enhancement from, in this case, a quadrupole deformation. So not an avocado shape, but just like a football shape will enhance the magnetic quadrupole moment of nuclei. So these experiments, they're very similar in many respects. So for an EDM, for like an electron EDM experiment, you're looking for a symmetry violating interaction between the electron spin and the internal field. In the nuclear shift moment, it turns out you're looking for basically the same thing, except you're looking for a nuclear spin dependence. For magnetic quadrupole moments, you're basically looking for a relative interaction between the electron spin and the nuclear spin. So the methods and requirements and approaches to these experiments are in principle very similar. The realizations can be fairly different, but kind of the ideas behind them are very similar. So people often just call all of these EDM experiments, even if you know you're looking for this, you're not looking for an EDM, but like it's an EDM experiment. And in all of these cases, they have the same features that they're proportional to polarization. You need heavy nuclei. You need core-penetrating electron orbitals, that sort of thing. And I talked about two different types of enhancements. So I just kind of want to make that a little more clear and explicit. There's an enhancement due to just these internal electromagnetic fields being large. But there's also, in some cases, intrinsic enhancements just due to the nuclear structure. And you can get, you know, both of these. For the electron EDM, turns out you don't care about the nuclear structure, so you just get this field enhancement. But for magnetic quadrupole moments or nuclear shift moments, you get intrinsic enhancements from the deformed structure of the nucleus. And I won't go over this, but I put it in the slides just like for your reference. It's like a summary of, and remember the slides are on the website. It's just a summary of like what features do you want for which thing and why. But you can ask questions about this later. So there are many different underlying sources of where these moments could come from. So in an experiment that's looking for the electron EDM, for example, okay, they're sensitive to the electron EDM, but it turns out they're also sensitive to CP violating couplings between the electron and the nucleus. If you're looking at these hadronic CP-violating things like nuclear shift moments or MQMs, those arise from completely different things, like quark or nucleon EDMs or CP-violating couplings between quarks or nuclei, nucleons, or theta QCD, et cetera. So there are a lot of, when you're doing these experiments, the actual sort of underlying physics that you're probing can be very broad. If you want to interpret these experiments robustly, not just as limits, but one day as measurements, you actually need experiments in multiple systems. You need multiple EDM experiments and nuclear shift moment MQM experiments in order to actually disentangle like where is the new physics coming from. So it's good. So people are pursuing these experiments in many different species, and that's actually really important. Another area where we need like very broad input is as an experimentalist, I'm looking for things like energy shifts. Ultimately, we want to connect it to say like new physics. So how do you make that connection? It's like, well, first you have to relate the measured energy shifts to things like, you know, the electron EDM or the nuclear shift moment or the magnetic quadrupole moment. So these are these, you know, sensitivity parameters. You know, how sensitive is the structure of the atom or molecule to these? And that requires some pretty serious atomic and molecular theory. For the nuclear stuff, you have this additional level of complexity if you want to relate, you know, the 173 ytterbium magnetic quadrupole moment to something a little more fundamental, like, you know, theta QCD or quark EDMs or something. You need some pretty serious, like, nuclear and QCD theory. And then if you want to go from these sort of fundamental parameters to new physics, you need high energy physics, high energy theory and phenomenology. So this area really relies on a lot of broad theory input as well. So with that, I'm gonna shift to talking about some contemporary experiments, but I'll maybe pause and see if there are any questions. You know, I may have to speed up a bit. I'm glad there have been a lot of questions, but I don't want to keep you all here too late. Although I could go on, I could just go on and on, never stopping. So again, this is not a review. I will not discuss all ongoing EDM experiments. I'm taking kind of a selection to give you a flavor of what's going on out there. One experiment, the first one I'll talk about is the mercury EDM experiment at the University of Washington. So they put mercury in a vapor cell, which is tiny. You know, it's a very much a tabletop experiment. Mercury has a nuclear spin. It has a spherical nucleus. It doesn't have this sort of octopole enhancement. But it's very heavy, it has highly relativistic electrons, so it has good sensitivity to a nuclear shift moment. So this is a nuclear shift moment experiment. And for this experiment, because they have a vapor cell, they have very, you know, sort of large numbers of atoms, because mercury is sort of a very fairly inert species electronically, it stays coherent for a long time. So the frequency resolution of this experiment is very, very good. It's very high. It's like 0.1 nanohertz. That's pretty impressive. It's sensitive mostly to the hadronic CP violation through the nuclear shift moment. So it's not really an electron EDM experiment. It's like looking at the nucleus. And if you assume, for example, that all the CP violation in their limit is coming from theta QCD, you can get a limit that, you know, that's pretty competitive with, say, you know, neutron EDM searches. There are other experiments that also use sort of atoms with similar structure, like there's like xenon EDM experiments have kind of similar nuclear spin, similar electron structure, although the experiments themselves actually look fairly different. Another atomic EDM experiment is the radium EDM experiment at Argonne. It's actually very, very similar to mercury and xenon. It has nuclear spin half. It basically doesn't have any electron EDM sensitivity, but it's nuclear shift moment sensitive. It's heavy, large field enhancement, but radium does have this octopole deformation, as I guess I showed it to you earlier. So it has sort of 1,000 times more intrinsic, meaning this like this internal amplification is like 1,000 times larger versus mercury. But there are challenges to working with it. It's radioactive. The half-life is only 2 weeks. And you can't make vapor cells out of it. So the number of atoms that you'll get is nowhere near as large as with mercury. But it has an advantage, which is that it's laser coolable. So you can load it into something called an optical dipole trap and cool it down to ultra cold temperatures and get really good access to highly coherent interactions, get long coherence times, you know, seconds. There's a sort of related experiment in ytterbium, USTC, which is kind of a test bed for radium. It has a lot of the similar features, but it's not radioactive. So it's just everything's, you know, it's easier to handle. And they, you know, very recently demonstrated some kind of advanced quantum methods in these EDM measurements, like quantum non-demolition, very long coherence times, et cetera. So on to, you know, molecules, that's what I get most excited about. The ytterbium fluoride experiment is an EDM experiment at Imperial College London, this molecule has a single unpaired valence electron and no nuclear spin. So it's an electron EDM experiment. And the way they do the experiment is by spin precession in a pulsed supersonic beam. And I'll just say a little bit more about how that works shortly. This experiment was the first one that beat atomic EDM experiments, or sort of beat the most sensitive atomic EDM experiment, which was a thallium experiment at Berkeley in 2002. They're upgrading this, so this experiment is still going on, and they've been doing a lot of neat stuff recently. this is an experiment you heard about earlier on someone else's talk. So thorium oxide, the ACME experiment. It's also a molecular spin precession experiment in a cryogenic beam, so conceptually it's actually very, very similar. it's currently the most sensitive experiment, EDM, electron EDM limit, first in 2014 and then the second generation in 2018. And it's currently being upgraded. Again, it's an active experiment, and they expect about an order of magnitude improvement in the next couple of years through technical improvements. So these beam experiments work like this, the YBF and THO beam experiments. You take a beam of molecules and you shoot them through an electric field and a magnetic field. The molecules pass through some lasers which polarize all the spins. So they're polarized lasers, so they polarize all the molecules and all the spins. Though they precess in fields, just like, you know, like your idealized EDM experiment, you let these things precess in fields. Then you read them out with another polarized laser. You collect the photons. You do some analysis. You can figure out how much they've precessed and then look for these correlations as you flip fields. That's the basic idea of how these beam experiments work. here's a photo of what one looks like. So I choose ACME generation one because I worked on this experiment, so it was very easy for me to get photos of it. The current generation 3 apparatus actually looks pretty similar. There's just a lot more stuff, but it gives you a sense of scale. You know, like that's a person. So this thing, the whole thing fits in a room. So they're, it's not quite tabletop, but it's pretty small. You could put it on a table if you wanted to. maybe in the interest of time, I'll just skip. You know, we make the molecules through cryogenic cooling. So one of the features of the ACME experiment, which was really important, which I will revisit, is they have a structural feature called parity doublets. So the ladder of rotational states in the molecule, each rotational state is actually split into a doublet of two closely spaced opposite parity states. Closely spaced opposite parity states means highly polarizable. You don't have to add as much of a perturbing field to mix these states and polarize the molecule. so you can polarize them in very small fields, but also this gives rise to a neat trick where you can, if you can fully polarize the molecule, you can operate the experiment in one of two states where the molecule dipole is polarized fully either one direction or the other. But that means because the electron, for example, is interacting with this internal field and the internal field direction is determined by the polarized molecular dipole, the internal field flips between these two states. And so that means you can sort of do your electric field reversal and look for the EDM without actually changing any external fields. and that's very important for rejecting systematic effects. Because, you know, of course, this is your idealized EDM experiment, but, you know, what's really happening is your fields are crooked, and when you flip them, they change direction and length a little bit, and this ability to reverse fields perfectly is really a big limitation for these experiments, but for molecules with this feature, you don't have to reverse the electric field. So that gives a lot of robustness against systematic errors, which are important because these effects you're looking for are very small. so another experiment where they use this parity doublet trick to do something really cool is the hafnium fluoride plus EDM experiment at Jilla and Boulder. They take molecular ions, so they have a charge, and they put them in an ion trap. and they rotate the field around so that the ions sort of stay in the trap, but they also use this rotating electric field to polarize the molecules. And because you can't reverse the electric field direction in an ion trap, you know, you always need the electric field to push the ions to the middle. If you flip the direction of the electric field, you get an anti-trap. You'll kick your electron your molecules out. But they can reverse this molecular dipole because this molecule has this neat structural feature. So that allows them to, the fact that they're trapped gives them access to very long coherence times. This experiment also is being upgraded, and they expect basically an order of magnitude-ish improvement on their last measurement within the next year or so, you know, maybe even a couple months. They did all their EDM data taking already, so. So maybe I'll pause here again and ask if there are any questions before I move on to looking ahead to the future a little bit.
Mercury and neutrons at the same time for an EDM, like I think 2007 or something. And you showed like a new one which only had mercury. Does it not help you to remove systematics of magnetic fields nowadays?
Yeah. So in that experiment, the mercury was a co-magnetometer, meaning they weren't actually looking for the EDM in mercury. They were using the fact. They were using the fact that it's very well measured that the atomic EDM of mercury is very, very, very small. So for the neutron EDM experiment, they just sort of ignored it and used the fact that mercury does have a magnetic moment. So you can use it to probe the magnetic fields in the apparatus in a species that's, you know, basically insensitive to electric fields. So that was, so they were interested in measuring the neutron EDM, and the mercury was like a diagnostic tool.
But can't you do, I mean, with two guys that we know don't have a strong electric dipole, do this subtraction, or would it just not help you because indeed they're not very sensitive?
Yeah, I think I don't know what kind of mercury EDM limit they could have set with that apparatus, but it's presumably much smaller than the dedicated mercury EDM experiment. But this sort of using dual species co-magnetometers is sort of a common trick. Sorry?
Much worse EDM limit.
Yeah. Yes. So for example, for the thallium EDM experiment, they actually used a mixture of thallium and sodium because sodium, because it's very light, it's basically insensitive to the electron EDM, but it's perfectly sensitive to magnetic fields. So they basically would, you know, sort of look for the EDM of sodium as a sort of a systematic check. All right. maybe I'll just, since I'm approaching the end of my time, or maybe I'm technically already there, maybe I'll just mention a few highlights. So these beam experiments are limited by time of flight to be a few milliseconds. If you could load them into a trap, you could extend it to seconds. Laser cooling and trapping is a powerful technique to do that. And some motivating numbers are, if you take some reasonable numbers, nobody's done this experiment yet, but all these numbers I think people would say are kind of realizable in the not too distant future. Million molecules, 100 second coherence time, heavy deformed nucleus, good quantum control, robust error ejection, and you integrate it for 2 weeks. That would give you access to roughly PEV, you know, with a capital P, PEV scale CP violating physics at one loop, or sort of 100 TeV scale CP violating physics at two loops, with very broad leptonic and hadronic CP violation sector coverage, and extreme precision, for example, you know, probing theta QCD down to like 10 to the minus 14. This is an experiment that we as a community think can be done in sort of like 10 years or something. So, you know, it's hopefully an exciting time to be alive. And there are sort of even sort of future down the road improvements from things like quantum enhanced metrology or really, really advanced nuclei. So even after doing this experiment, there's still stuff that you can do, although these things are a little more speculative. so Laser cooling is a technique which works by scattering a large number of photons off of molecules to apply forces, including cooling and trapping forces. That's kind of, at least for neutral species, that's sort of what you have to do to realize that experiment I described. And there are a few working on that. So one is ytterbium fluoride is basically upgrading their experiment with laser cooling and trapping to get longer coherence times. There's a barium fluoride EDM experiment, and electron EDM, and a thallium fluoride nuclear shift moment experiment. So all these molecules are laser coolable. And I skipped all the discussion of, like, why are they laser coolable? I think it's really interesting, but, you know, you can ask me later. polyatomic molecules give you a lot of degree control over the features of this molecule, things like electric and magnetic field interactions, polarizability. By swapping out the thing that's attached to, say, your metal, you can actually tune the properties of this molecule a lot. And because it turns out that the bond, for reasons that I skipped over, the electronic structure of these molecules, when you swap out, say, a fluorine for an OH or a CCH or something, it looks almost identical. It turns out it preserves things like the laser coolability, the CP violation sensitivity, which comes from electronic structure. so you can use a lot of the same techniques, you know, but with the ability to engineer a lot of other interesting features. For example, polyatomic molecules, it turns out, are always highly polarizable. Diatomic molecules are, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. So laser coolable, highly polarizable molecules with good EDM sensitivity, it turns out, basically have to be polyatomic. And so, you know, some people are doing stuff with polyatomic, like me, that's me. So this is, you know, this is my panel, and some other people too. So, you know, laser cooling and trapping polyatomic molecules for EDM searches, but also using polyatomic molecules to look for nuclear magnetic quadrupole moments. there's interest in using polyatomics, some interesting features of them to look for parity violation. So, you know, precision electroweak physics. And also combining these heavy deformed nuclei with ion trapping in, for example, you know, radium polyatomic molecular ions. but and lots of other interesting stuff like dark matter quantum sensing. You can do a lot of cool things with polyatomic molecules. Deformed nuclei, so I kind of talked about this a little bit before. They're interesting. Radium is, there gets a lot of attention because, like I mentioned, has this well-understood octopole deformation. The atom, the ion, and many molecules of radium can be laser-cooled. That's pretty unique. So it's a venue to basically combining and realizing sort of all of these things I talked about. So this radium EDM experiment, radium fluoride is laser-coolable and was recently studied at high resolution. You can assemble radium-containing molecules out of laser-cooled atoms. You can trap radium-containing polyatomic molecular ions. Radium-containing polyatomic molecules should also be laser coolable. And for example, by tuning the ligand on these radium-containing molecules, you can make the features of your molecule kind of match your experimental technique. So whether you want to use like quantum logic or clock measurement or spin precession, you can kind of engineer the ligand that you stick to your radium to give you whatever features that you want. These, by the way, have been created not too long ago in Andrew J.H.'s lab at UC Santa Barbara. because they're so sensitive, you get this octopole enhancement, the high field enhancement, et cetera. If you could only trap one of these at a time and do a precision measurement on it, you could sort of reach the frontier of nuclear symmetry violations, say like theta QCD. I'll conclude with a very brief outlook. So just in the last year, this is a growing area, and just in the last year, a lot of exciting stuff has happened. these radioactive molecular ions were created and trapped and cooled. Ultra-cold molecules have been now quantum controlled down to the sort of single molecule level. These sort of EDM sensitive polyatomic molecules have been trapped and cooled to ultra-cold temperatures and can be sort of coherently probed. There's been high resolution spectroscopy on a wide range of radioactive molecules. And people are doing, you know, ultra cold atomic EDM searches with extremely long coherence times, you know, like minutes. So lots of exciting stuff is happening. I didn't do most of this stuff, by the way. This all was from my group in the last year. It's a pretty big community doing all this stuff. I think we're excited because by combining all of these things that we're really kind of starting to make progress on, you can make some projections of like where is this field going? Where's the electron EDM limit going? And what sort of physics reach can you get? You know, we think by combining these things like improving existing experiments, new trapping technologies, advanced quantum control, deformed nuclei, we can push this down by orders of magnitude, within our lifetimes, down to like thousands of TeV one loop, hundreds of TeV two loop, and not just for the electron EDM, but for lots of things, hadronic CP violation, ultra-light dark matter, precision electroweak. This figures from the Snowmass EDM white paper if you'd like to learn more, or you can ask me. Here are some references if you'd like, selected just reviews, but you can also just, email me or ask me. And thanks a lot.
Jed was first.
Yeah, you can go first.
I have a silly little question, which is with atoms, I know that we're doing a couple of things for dark matter detection in a way that's like different from looking at the atoms themselves, so single photon detection and MAGIS we learned about yesterday, I think. So I'm wondering if you see that happening with molecules or if molecules are too hard.
To do things like sort of like dark matter detection?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah, great question. And there are people in this room who've thought about this and made proposals who can answer better than I can. But just to refer to one thing that was actually on the slide, like since I kind of mentioned it. There are specific instances where molecules have some advantage over atoms. For example, one of the advantages is that they have access to frequency ranges and therefore energy scales that atoms don't necessarily. That's like the fundamental law of like atoms versus molecules is like atoms, you can always measure everything more sensitively in terms of like absolute precision. So molecules, it only makes sense to work with a molecule if there's some specific advantage that they offer. And in this case, a specific advantage that they offer is that they have a wide range of energy levels in, say, like the infrared and mid-infrared and things that atoms don't. So, for example, in this in this experiment, which is underway at Harvard, they want to trap this molecule. This is strontium hydroxide, SROH, and it turns out there's a near degeneracy of two vibrational excited states. In that molecule, and if the electron-proton mass ratio changes, that splitting is very sensitive to it. And that changing of the electron-proton mass ratio is something that can arise in the presence of certain new types of like ultralight scalar fields, say like certain types of dark matter fields. So the idea is you basically measure this splitting very precisely and you see if it changes over time or see if it oscillates or something like that. There are also proposals to, for example, look for like absorption of dark matter particles because molecules again have sort of energy splittings that atoms don't have. You can just look for like spontaneous excitation of molecules as they absorb a dark matter particle, et cetera. So there are definitely instances where molecules have some interesting advantage in a particular frequency range, for example.
Thank you.
So you had this slide where you were saying, in maybe 10 years we could do theta QCD at 10 to negative 14, something like that. Yeah, this.
Yeah. Oops, I went too far. And it dropped. somewhere. Oh, it was like actually pretty far back. I forgot where it was. But yeah, that slide was in here somewhere. There we go. Great. Yeah.
So is this sensitive to theta QCD because it's sensitive to the neutron EDM, or is it sensitive to some loop correction to the electron EDM? What is the mechanism here?
I didn't tell you what molecule this is. Depends on the molecule. I didn't say which molecule because it's, you know, sort of just a, it's a general goal. But like, for example, if you picked something like a radium or protactinium or thorium containing molecule that both had unpaired electrons and a deformed spinful nucleus, you could get both of those. So you could measure both. If this was something without a nuclear spin, then you'd get only electron stuff. If it was something with, you know, no net electron spin, you'd get only nuclear stuff. So it depends on the species. If it has unpaired electrons, it'll be sensitive to the electron EDM, you know, usually. For the nuclear, so what it's specifically sensitive to in the hadronic sector depends on the nucleus. You know, whether it's more, like if it has an unpaired, if the nucleus has like a valence neutron, like mercury, it would be more sensitive to the neutron EDM. If it has an unpaired proton, or if it has a valence proton, like thallium, it would be more sensitive to the proton EDM. It turns out that the nucleus is always very sensitive to things like new CP violating forces, so like CP violating, you know, pion exchange, or like theta QCD. And so if you measured a nuclear shift moment, it's going back to when I said like we need multiple experiments. If you measured a nuclear shift moment in a molecule or atom, you could not say where it came from. Like you couldn't say like, oh, you know, d sub n is this and d sub p is this and theta is this. What you actually measure is some sum of those weighted by their sensitivities. But then if you measure it in a different species where the sensitivities are different, you know, now you start getting sort of intersections in parameter space and you can start nailing down where exactly it's coming from. But these nuclear experiments are sort of generically sensitive to kind of all of those things at the same time. So there really is a lot of motivation to pursue these experiments in different species. Even for the electron EDM, because it's not just electron EDM, it's also like electron nucleon couplings. So same story with electron EDM searches. If someone measures something, or when someone measures something, you won't be able to say like the electron EDM is this. You actually need another experiment in a different species to be able to say that.
Okay, and then that's really helpful. And then just asking about these kind of experimental parameters, what limits you? I know people keep an atom or something in an ion trap for years or something. So the 2 weeks integration time is that these guys are much harder to trap, or it's much harder to trap them in a big lattice.
What limits these numbers? For molecules, it's basically currently limited by just like our sources to create these molecules. They're free radicals that are very reactive with high melting points, so it's just hard to get like large quantities of them. But we're improved that, you know, the technology is getting better. This number of molecules people can trap has just in the last, it went from zero in 2013 to like 50 in 2014, and now it's up to like 10 to the 5. So it's, you know, I would like to extrapolate, but it probably won't keep going at that pace, because the efficiency is still going up, but at the end of the day, these molecules are just hard to make. But this, just based on the fact that people can now do 10 to the 5, 10, and there are some things that we know how to do better, 10 to the 6 seems reasonable. But if we could come up with some like magical molecular beam that just had like 100 times more molecules in it, this number would go up by 100. We're trying to make better molecular beams. This is motivated by kind of saying like, well, you know, what's the best people can do in other EDM experiments? It's like, well, it's about this. So for like the mercury EDM experiment, say looking at things like, you know, clocks or something. People are already doing several, you know, 5 second coherence times for trapped atoms, as of recently. That's kind of where these numbers come from. 2 weeks integration time is an empirical number based on how much data did all these molecular EDM experiments who have produced a limit, how much data did they ultimately use? And it's about 2 weeks for all of them. And that's mainly limited by 2 weeks integration means like 2 weeks of just averaging. It's 2 weeks to get your statistics. To get the systematic effects, you basically have to take your statistical integration time and multiply it by roughly 10. So, you know, it basically takes a year, you know, ish to get 2 weeks of data, of statistical data. And that's about the limit where, at which you'll just say like, well, just build a better version of the experiment. Unless you don't know how to do that. I hope that was sort of a meandering answer, but I hope it answered your question.
Very helpful, thank you.